When we came into Cana, we were broke and hungry and more than ready for a feast. At least most of us were. Joshua didn't know about the feast. The wedding was being held in the courtyard of a very large house. We could hear the drums and singers and smell spiced meat cooking as we approached the gates. It was a large wedding, and a couple of kids were waiting outside to tend to our camels. They were curly-haired, wiry little guys about 10 years old. They reminded me of evil versions of Josh and me at that age. "Sounds like a wedding going on," Joshua said. "Park your camel, sir," said the camel parking kid.
"It is a wedding," said Bart. "I thought we were here to help Maggie."
"Park your camel, sir," said the other kid, pulling on the reins of my camel. Joshua looked at me. "Where is Maggie? You said she was sick." "She's in the wedding," I said, pulling the reins back from the kid. "You said she was dying." "Well, we all are, aren't we? I mean, if you think about it," I grinned. "You can't park that camel here, sir." "Look, kid, I don't have any money to tip you. Go away." I hate handing my camel over to the camel parking kids. It unnerves me. I'm always sure that I'm never going to see it again, or it's going to come back with a tooth missing or an eye poked out. "So Maggie isn't really dying?" "Hey, guys," Maggie said, stepping out of the gate. "Maggie," Joshua said, throwing his arms up in surprise. Problem was, he was so intent on looking at her that he forgot to grab on again, and off the camel he went. He hit the ground face down with a thump and a wheeze. I jumped down from my camel. Bart's dogs barked. Maggie ran to Josh, rolled him over, and cradled his head in her lap while he tried to get his breath back. Philip and Nathaniel waved to people from the wedding who were peeping through the gate to see what all the commotion was about. Before I had a chance to turn, the two kids had leapt up onto our camels and were galloping around the corner off to Nod, or South Dakota, or some other place I didn't know the location of. "Maggie," Joshua said, "you're not sick." "That depends," she said, "if there's any chance of a laying on of hands." Joshua smiled and blushed. "I missed you." "Me too," Maggie said. She kissed Joshua on the lips and held him there until I started to squirm and the other disciples started to clear their throats and bark, "Get a room!" under their breaths. Maggie stood up and helped Joshua to his feet. "Come on in, guys," she said. "No dogs," she said to Bart. And the hulking cynic shrugged and sat down in the street amid his canine disciples. I was craning my neck to see if I could see where our camels had been taken. "They're going to run those camels into the ground, and I know they won't feed or water them." "Who?" asked Maggie. "Those camel parking boys." "Biff, this is my youngest brother's wedding. He couldn't even afford wine. He didn't hire any camel parking boys." Bartholomew stood and rallied his troops.
"I'll find them."
He lumbered off. Inside, we feasted on beef and mutton, all manner of fruits and vegetables, bean and nut pastes, cheese and first-pressed olive oil with bread. There was singing and dancing, and if it hadn't been for a few old guys in the corner looking very cranky, you'd never have known that there wasn't any wine at the party. When our people danced, they danced in large groups, lines and circles, not couples. There were men's dances and women's dances, and very few dances where both could participate, which is why people were staring at Joshua and Maggie as they danced. They were definitely dancing together. I retreated to a corner, where I saw Maggie's sister Martha watching as she nibbled at some bread with goat cheese. She was 25, a shorter, sturdier version of Maggie, with the same auburn hair and blue eyes, but with less tendency to laugh. Her husband had divorced her for a grievous skankage, and now she lived with her older brother, Simon, in Bethany. I'd gotten to know her when we were little, and she took messages to Maggie for me. She offered me a bite of her bread and cheese, and I took it. "She's going to get herself stoned," Martha said in slightly bitter, moderately jealous, younger sister tone. "Jakin is a member of the Sanhedrin."
"Is he still a bully?"
"Worse. Now he's a bully with power. he'd have her stoned just to prove that he could do it. For dancing? Not even the Pharisees. If anyone saw her kiss Joshua, then... So how are you? I said, changing the subject. I'm living with my brother Simon now. I heard. He's a leper. Look, there's Joshua's mother. I have to go say hello. There's no wine at this wedding, Mary said. I know. Strange, isn't it? James stood by scowling as I hugged his mother. Joshua is here too? Yes. Oh, good. I was afraid that you two might have been arrested along with John. Pardon me? I stepped back and looked to James for explanation. He seemed the more appropriate bearer of bad news. You hadn't heard? Herod has thrown John in prison for inciting people to revolt. That's the excuse, anyway. It's Herod's wife who wanted John silenced. She was tired of having John's followers refer to her as the slut. I patted Mary's shoulder as I stepped away. I'll tell Joshua you're here. I found Joshua sitting in a far corner of the courtyard playing with some children. One little girl had brought her pet rabbit to the wedding, and Joshua was holding it in his lap, petting its ears. Biff, come feel how soft this bunny is. Joshua, John has been arrested. Josh slowly handed the bunny back to the little girl and stood. When? I'm not sure. Shortly after we left, I guess. I shouldn't have left him. I didn't even tell him we were leaving. It was bound to happen, Joshua. I told him to lay off Herod, but he wouldn't listen. You couldn't have done anything. I'm the son of God. I could have done something. Yeah, you could have gone to prison with him. Your mother is here. Go talk to her. She's the one that told me. As Joshua embraced Mary, she said, You've got to do something about this wine situation. Where's the wine? James tapped Joshua on the shoulder. Didn't bring any wine with you from the lush vineyards of Jericho? I didn't like hearing sarcasm being used by James against Joshua. I had always thought of my invention as being used for good, or at least against people I didn't like. Joshua gently pushed his mother away. You shall have wine, he said. Then he went off to the side of the house, where drinking water was stored in large stone jars. In a few minutes, he returned with a pitcher of wine and cups for all of us. A shout went through the party, and suddenly everything seemed to step up a level. Pitchers and cups were filled and drained and filled again, and those who had been near the wine jars started declaring a miracle had been performed, that Joshua of Nazareth had turned water into wine. I looked for him, but he was nowhere to be found. Having been free of sin all of his life, Joshua wasn't very good at dealing with guilt. So he had gone off by himself to try to numb the guilt he felt over John's arrest. After a few hours of subterfuge and guile, I was able to get Maggie to sneak out the back gate with me. Maggie, come with us. You talked to Joshua. You saw the wine. He's the one. I've always known he was the one. But I can't come with you. I'm married. I thought you were going to be a fisherman. And I thought you were going to be a village idiot. I'm still looking for a village. Look, get Jachin to divorce you. Anything he can divorce me for, he can also kill me for. I've seen him pass judgment on people, Biff. I've seen him lead the mobs to the stonings. I'm afraid of him. I learned to make poisons in the East. I raised my eyebrows and grinned. Huh? I'm not going to poison my husband. I sighed an exasperated sigh that I'd learned from my mother. Then leave him and come away with us, far from Jerusalem where he can't reach you. He'll have to divorce you to save face. Why should I leave, Biff? So I can follow around a man who doesn't want me and wouldn't take me if he did? I didn't know what to say. I felt like knives were twisting in fresh wounds in my chest. I looked at my sandals and pretended to have something caught in my throat. Maggie stepped up, put her arms around me, and laid her head against my chest. I'm sorry, she said. I know. I missed both of you. But I missed just you, too. I know. I'm not going to sleep with you. I know. Then please, stop rubbing that against me. Sure. I said. Just then Joshua stumbled through the gate and crashed into us. We were able to catch ourselves and him before anyone fell. The Messiah was holding the little girl's pet bunny, hugging it to his cheek with the big back feet swinging free. He was gloriously drunk.
"No what?" Joshua said. "I love bunnies. They toil not, neither do they bark. Henceforth and from now on, I decree that whenever something bad happens to me, there shall be bunnies around. So it shall be written."
"Go ahead, Biff, write it down." He waved to me under the bunny, then turned and started back through the gate.
"Where's the friggin' wine? I got a dry bunny over here."
"See?" I said to Maggie. "You don't want to miss out on that. Bunnies." She laughed. My favorite music. "I'll get word to you," she said. "Where will you be?"
"I have no idea."
"I'll get word to you." It was midnight. The party had wound down, and the disciples and I were sitting in the street outside of the house. Joshua had passed out, and Bartholomew had put a small dog under his head for a pillow. Before he had left, James had made it abundantly clear that we weren't welcome in Nazareth.
"Well," said Philip, "I guess we can't go back to John."
"I'm sorry I didn't find the camels," Bartholomew said.
"People tease me about my yellow hair," said Nathaniel.
"I thought you were from Cana," I said. "Don't you have family we can stay with?"
"Plague," said Nathaniel.
"Plague," we all said, nodding. "It happens."
"You'll probably be needing these," came a voice out of the darkness.
We all looked up to see a short but powerfully built man walking out of the darkness, leading our camels.
"The camels," said Nathaniel.
"My apologies," said the man. "My brother's sons brought them home to us in Capernaum. I'm sorry it's taken so long to get them back to you."
I stood and he handed the camel's reins to me.
"They've been fed and watered."
He pointed to Joshua, who was snoring away on his terrier.
"Does he always drink like that?"
"Only when a major prophet has been imprisoned." The man nodded.
"I heard what he did with the wine. They say he also healed a lame man in Cana this afternoon. Is that true?"
We all nodded.
"If you have no place to stay, you can come home with me to Capernaum for a day or two. We owe you at least that for taking your camels."
"We don't have any money," I said.
"Then you'll feel right at home," said the man. "My name is Andrew."
And so we became six. Chapter 26. You can travel the whole world, but there are always new things to learn. For instance, on the way to Capernaum, I learned that if you hang a drunk guy over a camel and slosh him around for about 4 hours, then pretty much all the poisons will come out one end of him or the other.
"Someone's going to have to wash that camel before we go into town," said Andrew.
We were traveling along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, which wasn't a sea at all. The moon was almost full, and it reflected in the lake like a pool of quicksilver. It fell to Nathaniel to clean the camel, because he was the official new guy. Joshua hadn't really met Andrew, and Andrew hadn't really agreed to join us, so we couldn't count him as the official new guy yet. Since Nathaniel did such a fine job on the camel, we let him clean up Joshua as well. Once he had the Messiah in the water, Joshua came out of his stupor long enough to slur something like,
"The foxes have their holes and birds have their nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head."
"That's so sad," said Nathaniel.
"Yes, it is," I said. "Dunk him again. He still has barf on his beard."
And so, cleansed and slung over a camel damply, Joshua did by moonlight come into Capernaum, where he would be welcomed as if it were his home.
"Out!" screeched the old woman. "Out of the house! Out of town! Out of Galilee for all I care! You aren't staying here!"
It was a beautiful dawn over the lake, the sky painted with yellow and orange. Gentle waves lapped against the keels of Capernaum's fishing boats.
The village was only a stone's throw away from the water, and golden sunlight reflected off the waves onto the black stone walls of the houses, making the light appear to dance to the calls of the gulls and songbirds. The houses were built together in two big clusters, sharing common walls, with entries from every which way, and none more than one story tall. There was a small main road through the village between the two clusters of homes. Along the way were a few merchant booths, a blacksmith shop, and, on its own little square, a synagogue that looked as if it could contain far more worshippers than the 300 residents of the village. But villages were thick along the shores of the lake, one running right into the next, and we guessed that perhaps the synagogue served a number of villages. There was no central square around the well, as there was in most inland villages, because the people pulled their water from the lake or a spring nearby that bubbled clean, chilly water into the air as high as two men. Andrew had deposited us at his brother Peter's house, and we had fallen asleep in the great room among the children only a few hours before Peter's mother-in-law awoke to chase us out of the house. Joshua was holding his head with both hands as if to keep it from falling off his neck. "I won't have freeloaders and scalawags in my house," the old woman shouted as she threw my satchel out after us. "Ouch," said Joshua, flinching from the noise. "We're in Capernaum, Josh," I said. "A man named Andrew brought us here because his nephew stole our camels." "You said Maggie was dying," Joshua said. "Would you have left John if I told you that Maggie wanted to see you?"
"No," he smiled dreamily. "It was good to see Maggie." Then the smile turned to a scowl.
"Alive?"
"John wouldn't listen, Joshua. You were in the desert all last month. You didn't see all of the soldiers, even the scribes hiding in the crowd, writing down what John was saying. This was bound to happen."
"Then you should have warned John."
"I warned John. Every day I warned John. He didn't listen to reason any more than you would have."
"We have to go back to Judea. John's followers will become your followers. No more preparation, Josh."
Joshua nodded, looking at the ground in front of him. "It's time. Where are the others?"
"I've sent Philip and Nathaniel to Sepphoris to sell the camels. Bartholomew is sleeping in the reeds with the dogs."
"We're going to need more disciples," Joshua said.
"We're broke, Josh. We're going to need disciples with jobs."
An hour later, we stood on the shore near where Andrew and his brother were casting nets. Peter was taller and leaner than his brother, and he had a head of gray hair wilder than even John the Baptist's, while Andrew pushed his dark hair back and tied it with a cord so it stayed out of his face when he was in the water. They were both naked, which is how men fish the lake when they were close to the shore. I had mixed a headache remedy for Joshua out of tree bark, and I could tell it was working, but perhaps not quite enough. I pushed Joshua toward the shore.
"I'm not ready for this. I feel terrible."
"Ask them."
"Andrew," Joshua called, "thank you for bringing us home with you, and you too, Peter."
"Did my mother-in-law toss you out?" asked Peter. He cast his net and waited for it to settle, then dove into the lake and gathered the net in his arms. There was one tiny fish inside. He reached in and pulled it out, then tossed it back in the lake.
"Grow," he said.
"You know who I am?" said Joshua.
"I've heard," said Peter. "Andrew says you turned water into wine, and you cured the blind and the lame. He thinks that you're going to bring the kingdom."
"What do you think?"
"I think my little brother is smarter than I am, so I believe what he says."
"Come with us. We're going to tell people of the kingdom. We need help."
"What can we do?" said Andrew. "We're only fishermen."
"Come with me, and I'll make you fishers of men." Andrew looked at his brother, who was still standing in the water. Peter shrugged and shook his head. Andrew looked at me, shrugged, and shook his head.
"They don't get it," I said to Joshua.
Thus, after Joshua had some food and a nap and explained what in the hell he meant by fishers of men, we became seven. "These guys are our partners," Peter said, hurrying us along the shore. "They own the ships that Andrew and I work on. We can't go spread the good news unless they are in on it, too. We came to another small village, and Peter pointed out two brothers who were fitting a new oarlock into the gunwale of a fishing boat. One was lean and angular, with jet black hair and a beard trimmed into wicked points. James. The other was older, bigger, softer, with big shoulders and chest, but small hands and thin wrists, a fringe of brown hair shot with gray around a sunburned, bald pate. John.
Just a suggestion, Peter said to Joshua. Don't say the fisher of men thing. It's going to be dark soon. You won't have time for the explanation if we want to make it home in time for supper.
Yeah, I said. Just tell them about the miracles, the kingdom, a little about your Holy Ghost thing, but stay easy on that until they agree to join up.
I still don't get the Holy Ghost thing, said Peter.
It's okay, we'll go over it tomorrow, I said.
As we moved down the shore toward the brothers, there was a rustling in some nearby bushes, and three piles of rags moved into our path.
Have mercy on us, Rabbi, said one of the piles.
Lepers. I need to say something right here. Joshua taught me about the power of love and all that stuff, and I know that the divine spark in them is the same one that is in me, so I should have not let the presence of lepers bother me. I know that announcing them unclean under the law was as unjust as the Brahmins shunning the untouchables. I know that even now. Having watched enough television, you probably wouldn't even refer to them as lepers so as to spare their feelings. You probably call them parts dropping off challenged or something. I know all that. But that said, no matter how many healings I saw, lepers always gave me what we Hebrews call the willies. I never got over it.
What is it you want? Joshua asked them.
Help ease our suffering, said a female-sounding pile.
I'll be over there looking at the water, Josh, I said.
He'll probably need some help, Peter said.
Come to me, Joshua said to the lepers. They oozed on over. Joshua put his hand on the lepers and spoke to them very quietly.
After a few minutes had passed, while Peter and I had seriously studied a frog that we noticed on the shore, I heard Joshua say, Now go, and tell the priests that you are no longer unclean and should be allowed in the temple, and tell them who sent you. The lepers threw off their rags and praised Joshua as they backed away. They looked like perfectly normal people who just happened to be all wrapped up in tattered rags. By the time Peter and I got back to Joshua, James and John were already at his side.
I have touched those who they said were unclean, Joshua said to the brothers. By Mosaic law, Joshua would be unclean as well.
James stepped forward and grabbed Joshua's forearm in the style of the Romans.
One of those men used to be our brother.
Come with us, I said, and we will make you oarlock makers of men.
What? Said Joshua.
That's what they were doing when we came up, making an oarlock. Now you see how stupid that sounds?
It's not the same.
And thus did we become nine.
Philip and Nathanael returned with enough money from the sale of the camels to feed the disciples and all of Peter's family as well. So Peter's screeching mother-in-law, who was named Esther, allowed us to stay, providing Bartholomew and the dog slept outside. Capernaum became our base of operations, and from there we would take 1 or 2 day trips, swinging through Galilee as Joshua preached and performed healings. The news of the coming of the kingdom spread through Galilee, and after only a few months, crowds began to gather to hear Joshua speak. We tried always to be back in Capernaum on the Sabbath so that Joshua could teach at the synagogue. It was that habit that first attracted the wrong sort of attention. A Roman soldier stopped Joshua as he was making the short walk to the synagogue on Sabbath morning. No Jew was permitted to make a journey of more than 1,000 steps from sundown Friday until sundown Saturday. All at once, that is. One way. You didn't have to add up your steps all day and just stop when you got to 1,000. There would have been Jews standing all over the place waiting for Saturday sundown if that were the case. It would have been awkward. Suddenly I'm thankful that the Pharisees never thought of that. The Roman was no mere legionnaire, but a centurion, with the full-crested helmet and eagle on his breastplate of a legion commander. He led a tall, white horse that looked as if it had been bred for combat. He was old for a soldier, perhaps 60, and his hair was completely white when he removed his helmet. But he looked strong, and the wasp-waisted short sword at his waist looked dangerous. I didn't recognize him until he spoke to Joshua in perfect, unaccented Aramaic.
"Joshua of Nazareth," the Roman said, "do you remember me?"
"Justice," Joshua said, "from Sepphoris."
"Gaius Justus Gallicus," said the soldier, "and I'm at Tiberias now, and no longer an under-commander. The 6th Legion is mine. I need your help, Joshua Bar Joseph of Nazareth."
"What can I do for you?"
Joshua looked around. All of the disciples except Bartholomew and me had managed to sneak away when the Roman walked up.
"I saw you make a dead man walk and talk. I've heard of things you've done all over Galilee. The healings, the miracles. I have a servant who is sick, tortured with palsy. He can barely breathe, and I can't watch him suffer. I don't ask that you break your Sabbath by coming to Tiberias, but I believe you can heal him, even from here."
Justus dropped to his knee and kneeled in front of Joshua, something I never saw any Roman do to any Jew before or since.
"This man is my friend," he said.
Joshua touched the Roman's temple, and I watched the fear drain out of the soldier's face as I had so many others. "You believe it to be, so be it," said Joshua. "It's done. Stand up, Gaius Justus Gallicus." The soldier smiled, then stood and looked Joshua in the eye.
"I would have crucified your father to root out the killer of that soldier."
"I know," said Joshua.
"Thank you," Justus said.
The centurion put on his helmet and climbed on his horse, then looked at me for the first time.
"What happened to that pretty little heartbreaker you two were always with?"
"Broke our hearts," I said. Justus laughed.
"Be careful, Joshua of Nazareth," he said.
He reined the horse around and rode away.
"Go with God," Joshua said.
"Good, Josh. That's the way to show the Romans what's going to happen to them come the kingdom."
"Shut up, Biff."
"Oh, so you bluffed him? He's going to get home and his friend will still be messed up?"
"Remember what I told you at the gates of Gaspar's monastery, Biff? That if someone knocked, I'd let them in?"
"Ack! Parables. I hate parables."
Tiberias was only an hour's fast ride from Capernaum, so by morning, word had come back from the garrison. Justus's servant had been healed. Before we had even finished our breakfast, there were 4 Pharisees outside of Peter's house looking for Joshua.
"You performed a healing on the Sabbath?"
the oldest of them asked. He was white-bearded and wore his prayer shawl and phylacteries wrapped about his upper arms and forehead.
"What a jamoke."
"Sure, we all had phylacteries. Every man got them when he turned 13. But you pretended that they were lost after a few weeks. You didn't wear them. You might as well wear a sign that said, 'Hi, I'm a pious geek.'" The one he wore on his forehead was a little leather box about the size of a fist that held parchments inscribed with prayers and looked, well, as if someone had strapped a little leather box to his head. Need I say more?
"Nice phylacteries," I said.
The disciples laughed. Nathaniel made an excellent donkey braying noise.
"You broke the Sabbath," said the Pharisee.
"I'm allowed," said Josh. "I'm the Son of God."
"Oh, fuck," Philip said. "Way to ease them into the idea, Josh," I said.
The following Sabbath, a man with a withered hand came to the synagogue while Joshua was preaching, and after the sermon, while 50 Pharisees, who had gathered at Capernaum just in case something like this happened, looked on, Joshua told the man that his sins were forgiven.
then healed the withered hand. Like vultures to carrion, they came to Peter's house the next morning.
No one but God can forgive sins, said the one they had elected as their speaker.
Really? Said Joshua. So you can't forgive someone who sins against you?
No one but God.
I'll keep that in mind, said Joshua. Now, unless you are here to hear the good news, go away. And Joshua went into Peter's house and closed the door. The Pharisee shouted at the door,
You blaspheme, Joshua Bar-Joseph! You!
And I was standing there in front of him, and I know I shouldn't have done it, but I popped him. Not in the mouth or anything, but right in the phylacteries. The little leather box exploded with the impact, and the strips of parchment slowly settled to the ground. I'd hit him so fast that I think he thought it was a supernatural event. A cry went up from the group behind him, protesting, shouting that I couldn't do such a thing, that I deserved stoning, scourging, etc. And my Buddhist tolerance just wore a little thin. So I popped him again, in the nose. This time he went down. Two of his pals caught him, and another one at the front of the crowd started to reach into his sash for something. I knew that they could quickly overrun me if they wanted to, but I didn't think they would. The cowards. I grabbed the man who was pulling the knife, twisted it away from him, shoved the iron blade between the stones of Peter's house, and snapped it off, then handed the hilt back to him. Go away, I said to him, very softly. He went away, and all of his pals went with him. I went inside to see how Joshua and the others were getting along. You know, Josh, I said, I think it's time to expand the ministry. You have a lot of followers here. Maybe we should go to the other side of the lake, out of Galilee for a while.
Preach to the Gentiles? Nathaniel asked.
He's right, said Joshua. Biff is right.
So it shall be written, I said.
James and John only owned one ship that was large enough to hold all of us and Bartholomew's dogs, and it was anchored at Magdala, 2 hours' walk south of Capernaum. So we made the trip very early one morning to avoid being stopped in the villages on the way. Joshua had decided to take the good news to the Gentiles, so we were going to go across the lake to the town of Gadarene in the state of Decapolis. They kept Gentiles there. As we waited on the shore at Magdala, a crowd of women who had come to the lake to wash clothes gathered around Joshua and begged him to tell them of the kingdom. I noticed a young tax collector who was sitting nearby at his table in the shade of a reed umbrella. He was listening to Joshua, but I could also see his eyes following the behinds of the women. I sidled over.
He's amazing, isn't he? I said.
Yes, amazing, said the tax collector. He was perhaps 20, thin, with soft brown hair, a light beard, and light brown eyes.
What's your name, publican?
Matthew, he said, son of Alphaeus.
No kidding. That's my father's name, too.
Look, Matthew, I assume you can read, write, things like that.
Oh, yes.
You're not married, are you?
No, I was betrothed, but before the wedding was to happen, her parents let her marry a rich widower.
Sad. You're probably heartbroken. That's sad. You see those women? There's women like that all the time around Joshua. And here's the best part. He's celibate. He doesn't want any of them. He's just interested in saving mankind and bringing the kingdom of God to earth, which we all are, of course. But the women, well, I think you can see.
That must be wonderful.
Yeah, it's swell. We're going to Decapolis. Why don't you come with us?
I couldn't. I've been entrusted to collect taxes for this whole coast.
He's the Messiah, Matthew. The Messiah. Think of it. You and the Messiah.
I don't know.
Women? The kingdom? You heard about him turning water into wine.
I really have to...
Have you ever tasted bacon, Matthew?
Bacon? Isn't that from pigs?
Unclean? Joshua's the Messiah. The Messiah says it's okay. It's the best thing you've ever eaten, Matthew. Women love it. We eat bacon every morning, with the women, really.
I'll need to finish up here,
Matthew said. You do that. Here, I'd like you to mark something for me. I looked over his shoulder at the ledger and pointed to a few names. Meet us at the ship when you're ready, Matthew. I went back over to the shore where James and John had pulled the ship in close enough for us to wade out to. Joshua finished up blessing the women and sent them back to their laundry with a parable about stains. Gentlemen, I called. Excuse me, James, John, you two, Peter, Andrew. You will not need to worry about your taxes this season. They've been taken care of. What? Said Peter. Where did you get the money? I turned and waved toward Matthew, who was running toward the shore. This good fellow is the publican Matthew. He's here to join us. Matthew ran up beside me and stood grinning like an idiot while trying to catch his breath. Hey, he said, waving weakly to the disciples. Welcome, Matthew, Joshua said. All are welcome in the kingdom. Joshua shook his head, turned, and waded out to the ship. He loves you, kid, I said. Loves you. Thus, we did become 10. Joshua fell asleep on a pile of nets with Peter's wide, straw fishing hat over his face. Before I settled down to be rocked to sleep myself, I sent Philip to the back of the boat to explain the kingdom and the Holy Ghost to Matthew. I figured that Philip's acumen with numbers might help out when talking to a tax collector. The two sets of brothers sailed the ship, which was wide of beam and small of sail, and very, very slow. About halfway across the lake, I heard Peter say, I don't like it. It looks like a tempest. I sat bolt upright and looked at the sky, and indeed, there were black clouds coming over the hills to the east, low and fast, clawing at the trees with lightning as they passed. Before I had a chance to sit up, a wave broke over the shallow gunwale and soaked me to the core. I don't like this. We should go back, said Peter, as a curtain of rain whipped across us. The ship's too full and the draft too shallow to weather a storm. Not good, not good, not good, chanted Nathaniel. Bartholomew's dogs barked and howled at the wind. James and Andrew trimmed the sail and put the oars in the water. Peter moved to the stern to help John with a long steering oar. Another wave broke over the gunwale, washing away one of Bartholomew's disciples, a mangy terrier type. Water was mid-shin deep in the bottom of the boat. I grabbed the bucket and began bailing and signaled Philip to help, but he had succumbed to the most rapid case of seasickness I had ever even heard of and was retching over the side. Lightning struck the mast, turning everything a phosphorus white. The explosion was instant and left my ears ringing. One of Joshua's sandals floated by me in the bottom of the boat.
We're doomed,
wailed Bart.
Doomed!
Joshua pushed the fishing hat back on his head and looked at the chaos around him. O ye of little faith, he said. He waved his hand across the sky, and the storm stopped. Just like that. Black clouds were sucked back over the hills. The water settled to a gentle swell, and the sun shone down bright and hot enough to raise steam off of our clothes. I reached over the side and snatched the swimming doggy out of the waves. Joshua had laid back down with a hat over his face. Is the new kid looking? He whispered to me. Yeah, I said. He impressed? His mouth is hanging open. He looks sort of stricken. Great. Wake me when we get there. I woke him a little before we reached Gadarene because there was a huge madman waiting for us on the shore, foaming at the mouth, screaming, throwing rocks, and eating the occasional handful of dirt. Hold up there, Peter, I said. The sails were down again, and we were rowing in. I should wake the master, said Peter. No, it's okay. I have this stop for foaming madmen authority. Nevertheless, I kicked the Messiah gently. Josh, you might want to take a look at this guy. Look, Peter, said Andrew, pointing to the madman. He has hair just like yours. Joshua sat up, pushed back Peter's hat, and glanced to the shore. Onward, he said. You sure?
Rocks were starting to land in the boat.
Oh, yeah, said Joshua.
He's very large, said Matthew, clarifying the already clear.
And mad, said Nathaniel, not to be outdone in stating the obvious.
He is suffering, said Joshua. Onward.
A rock as big as my head thudded into the mast and bounced into the water.
I'll rip your legs off and kick you in the head as you crawl around bleeding to death, said the madman.
Sure you don't want to swim in from here? Peter said, dodging a rock.
Nice, refreshing swim after a nap, said James.
Matthew stood up in the back of the boat and cleared his throat.
What is one tormented man compared to the calming of a storm? Were you all in the same boat I was?
Onward, Peter said. And onward we went, the big boat full of Joshua and Matthew and the 8 faithless pieces of shit that were the rest of us. Joshua was out of the boat as soon as we hit the beach. He walked straight up to the madman, who looked as if he could crush the Messiah's head in one of his hands. Filthy rags hung in tatters on him, and his teeth were broken and bleeding from eating dirt. His face contorted and bubbled, as if there were great worms under the skin searching for an escape. His hair was wild and stuck out in a great grayish tangle, and it did sort of look like Peter's hair.
Have mercy on me, said the madman. His voice buzzed in his throat like a chorus of locusts.
I slid out of the boat, and the others followed me quietly up behind Joshua.
What is your name, demon? Joshua asked.
What would you like it to be?
Said the demon.
You know, I've always been partial to the name Harvey, Joshua said.
Well, isn't that a coincidence? Said the demon. My name just happens to be Harvey.
You're just messing with me, aren't you? Said Josh.
Yeah, I am, said the demon, busted. My name's Legion, for there are a bunch of us in here.
Out, Legion, Josh commanded. Out of this big guy.
There was a herd of pigs nearby, doing piggy things. I don't know what they were doing. I'm a Jew. What do I know from pigs? Except that I like bacon.
A great green glow came out of Legion's mouth, whipped through the air like smoke, then came down on the herd of pigs like a cloud. In a second, it was sucked into the pigs' nostrils, and they began foaming and making locust noises.
Be gone, said Joshua.
With that, the pigs all ran into the sea, sucked huge lungfuls of water, and after only a little kicking, drowned. Perhaps 50 dead pigs bobbed in the swell.
How can I thank you? Said the big foaming guy, who had stopped foaming but was still big.
Tell the people of your land what has happened, Joshua said. Tell them the Son of God has come to bring them the good news of the Holy Ghost.
Clean up a little before you tell them, I said.
And off he went, a lumbering monster, bigger even than our own Bartholomew, and smelling worse, which I hadn't thought possible. We sat down on the beach and were sharing some bread and wine when we heard the crowd approaching through the hills.
The good news travels quickly, said Matthew, whose fresh-faced enthusiasm was starting to irritate me a little now.
Who killed our pigs?
The crowd was carrying rakes and pitchforks and scythes, and they didn't look at all like they were there to receive the gospel.
You fuckers! Kill them!
In the boat, said Josh.
O ye of little... Matthew's comment was cut short by Bart grabbing him by the collar and dragging him down the beach to the boat. The brothers had already pushed off and were up to their chests in the water. They pulled themselves in, and James and John helped set the oars as Peter and Andrew pulled us into the boat. We fished Bart's disciples out of the waves by the scruffs of their necks and set sail just as rocks began to rain down on us. We all looked at Joshua.
What? He said. If they'd been Jews, that pig thing would have gone over great. I'm new at Gentiles.